Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, second hour of our great big Wednesday show. And we start by asking you if you're pro-choice, because if you are a pro-choice person, this is your hour. Give us a call, 888-318-7884. Are you committed to the idea that abortion is a woman's right? Or maybe you're not fully committed to that idea, but you believe it that the law should allow a woman to make that choice for herself, or how do they say it, with her doctor, or if that's your view and you're willing to talk about it with us, we would love to discuss it. 888-318-7884. If you're pro-life and you'd like to discuss that, we ask that you wait for another day. Today, we want to dialogue with folks who believe in abortion, or at the very least believe abortion should be kept legal. And so we keep the line open for them. And that number, 888-318-7884. We won't bite you. We won't be mean to you. But we would love to have this discussion. Our guest this hour is international pro-life speaker Stephanie Gray. Stephanie's the co-founder of the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform, where she spent 12 years as executive director. She's the author of Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating Truth, as well as A Physician's Guide to Discussing Abortion. She holds a certification with distinction in healthcare ethics from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Stephanie Gray, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me back on.
So, again, I will reiterate that we're looking for pro-choice callers. A lot of times we get pro-life folks who are just eager to call and discuss it on these days, and we just ask you to hold off. We do that pretty much every other day of the week. We make that available. So today, let the pro-choice callers call 888-318-7884. I know, Stephanie, this is not you get very low anxiety about these discussions. You don't you're prepared. I know this because you were just talking to the first medical not to talk well. You were having a debate at Berkeley, of all places, with the first medical director of Planned Parenthood. Is that right? Have I got his title correct?
Right? Yes. Of the International Planned Parenthood Federation, so IPPF, the international body.
Yeah,
I guess my anxiety level goes higher when I'm around spiders than when I'm doing abortion debates. So it is something that I do feel quite made for, you could say. And I had the opportunity to return to Berkeley and to debate Malcolm Potts for a fourth time in front of his students. He oversees a class at Berkeley. Many of the students will become physicians, and so it's an incredible opportunity to be able to share a platform to present the pro-life message.
So this guy is, and I shouldn't say that. I don't mean that to sound dismissive, but this man is a doctor himself. He is an abortionist himself. He has performed many abortions. Yes. He trains other doctors, and he allows you to come in and debate the whole thing with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually, I mean, my guess is that he must be pushing 80 years old. He actually was instrumental in the legalization of abortion in Great Britain, where he's originally from.
Oh.
And after growing up and pursuing education, pursuing medicine in England, he eventually moved to the United States. He's done a lot of overseas work, pushing abortion and pushing contraception in poorer countries. So to, again, have the opportunity to present an opposite perspective, grounded in natural law, grounded in human rights. Interestingly, he's the one that always brings in religion into the debate. And knowing it's a secular audience, I don't bring religion up into the debate. So it's interesting that he does that.
Sometimes that's a little bit of a trick, I think. Oh, that's your religious view or something. And the debate about abortion does not have to involve religion at all. It certainly is a moral debate. It's a debate about what's moral and what's not. But it can be waged on scientific terms with what science has discovered about the origins of human life. And as long as your interlocutor is someone who believes in right and wrong, you can have that conversation.
Correct.
I suppose if there's someone who just doesn't believe in right and wrong, there's no basis for much discussion.
Well, there isn't, but that would go well beyond abortion into other topics as well. And so exactly as you say, you know, the way I framed things with the students was to ask the question, do we believe in human rights? And if we believe in human rights, the question is, who gets human rights? And the obvious answer is humans. So all we need to do is look to science to determine when a human begins his or her life. And if we can establish that scientifically, then the human rights we claim to embrace would automatically apply in the case of the preborn child, like we acknowledge it applies in the case of a born child.
So you treat a human as a species, and once you're a member of that species, you get all the rights that a member of that species gets.
Exactly. And what I always like to point out is the United Nations, which is typically perceived as a pro-abortion organization at a very foundational level with its human rights doctrines, has an anti-abortion philosophy because their Universal Declaration of Human Rights explicitly says everyone has the right to life. And in their preamble, everyone is defined as all members of the human family. So it really is, as you point out, like whether you're a member of the species Homo sapiens or not. So according to the UN, if you're a member of the human family, you not only have the right to life, but in Article 6 of that document, you automatically should be considered a person around the world. So all I do in my presentations is I look to science to establish the one-celled embryo at fertilization is a human being. And by virtue of being a member of the human family, then the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights would apply to that child, giving that child a human status and personhood status.
And we have Eleanor Roosevelt to thank for that. She's the great she was the great kind of energy behind that Universal Declaration following the horrors of the Second World War and the mass murder of Jews in particular and others. But primarily, I think the world was cognizant that, this genocide has just happened. We need a document that expresses what the whole human family believes about what it is to be a human being. As that fades into – I suppose the slogan is never forget, but – we do seem to be doing a lot of forgetting. As the memory of that fades, I think we have less commitment, don't we, to universal human rights?
Yes, we are forgetting that, and it's so important that we continually bring history up so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. And I think what is significant about, as you pointed out, the document being adopted shortly after the end of the Second World War, the end of the Holocaust, was you had human beings who weren't considered persons, namely Jews. And so the whole point of the document was not to create a declaration on the rights of persons. It was to create a declaration on the rights of humans, that which is an objective category, which we can determine scientifically. And if you fit into that objective category, then you're automatically considered a person. And if we play around with that, then we're going to have human rights violations like we had had in the early 1940s. And so that document was created to try to avoid a repeating of that horrible human rights violation.
888-318-7884 is our number. Stephanie Gray is our guest. If you prefer the spelled version of it, it's 888-31-TRUTH, 888-31-TRUTH. So how amenable do you find these young scholars preparing to be physicians to your message of universal human rights?
You know, it's mixed. Some people, I would say, are ignorant and other people are in denial. And there's a difference there, an important difference. Someone who's ignorant simply does not know. And so when I communicate the facts of when life begins, the history of human rights doctrines, a lot of people, even if they don't change in an instant, will say, that's interesting. I'd never heard that before. Those are the people who are ignorant, and they're very likely to be enlightened by information that I provide. Someone who's in denial is very different, and that's a more challenging person to engage. A lot of the students I find, by being in denial, it's not that they don't know, it's that they don't want to know the information. They've set up an emotional wall, a block, because perhaps they've had an abortion or their mothers have or someone close to them has, or they perhaps facilitate an abortion by driving someone to a clinic. And so with these individuals, really, I think it's the one-on-one encounters that can happen after presentations where you learn their stories and they see that you care about them that can start to build a bridge to hopefully gradually move them out of denial into ignorance, into knowledge and enlightenment and all of that.
888-318-7884, again, is the number. We have to take a quick break, and I want to just set the ground rules real clearly before we do. If you are a pro-choice person and would like to share with us your thoughts on being pro-choice, if you want to argue with us that your position is more reasonable than our position, we're not trying to hide our position. We are fully committed pro-life people at every stage of human life. But we also love to have conversation and dialogue. And if you're willing to dialogue with us, again, dial that number, 888-318-7884. Pro-life callers, hang on. Every other hour of the week is yours. This hour is for pro-choice callers, and we'll be right back with your calls, pro-choice folks, for Stephanie Gray right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
What difference does it make who or what you worship or what you believe? Sharing the faith used to make some people mad because it challenged their own strong beliefs. Today, it makes a lot of people yawn because they don't have strong beliefs about anything. Religious indifference is the great spiritual sickness of our age, a product of the relativism that dominates modern culture. This is Matt Nelson, and in my new book, Just Whatever, I'll take down the building blocks of religious indifference one by one. We'll look at the different kinds of indifference you tend to encounter in your friends and family members to see where they come from and why they're seductive. What you believe matters. Find out why and what to do about it in my new book, Just Whatever. You can order your copy of Just Whatever by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tim Staples here. Since May is the month of Mary and Mother's Day, I'm offering a great opportunity for you to help yourself, your family, and your friends to get to know our Blessed Mother more deeply than ever before. And to help make that happen, we're offering my book, Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines, for only $9.95. Folks, that's over 45% off the regular price. From her Immaculate Conception to the Annunciation, from her title as Mother of God to her perpetual virginity, from her assumption into heaven to her role as co-redemptrix, I'll give you all the facts and back them up with solid biblical evidence in a way that's easy to read, remember, and understand. Make this May the month you, your friends, and your family grow closer to the Mother of the Church, our Mother Mary. To get your copies of Behold Your Mother, call 1-888-291-8000 or log on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Pope Francis said, "All of us are called to mature in our work as evangelizers. We want to have better training, a deepening love, and a clearer witness to the gospel. St. Paul Street Evangelization's online school of evangelization will equip you with the tools you need to be an effective evangelist. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you're unable to give, we'll set you up for free. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and we open our lines solely to pro-choice folks today. We'd like to learn from you why you are pro-choice, and maybe accept your correction if you want to correct us on anything, but also provide our view as pro-life people, which is something we are not trying to be sneaky about or hide. We are 100% pro-life here at Catholic Answers. Before we get to those calls, however, I do have to welcome our Chief Operating Officer, John Sorensen. I have to, because he's our Chief Operating Officer. I have no choice in him.
Yeah, and I'm not going to ask a question because I'm pro-life, man.
Oh, yeah, that's right. No questions for you, John.
That's right.
But I did want to ask you about something because I've been learning about this as I go. But you have this Bible project that you and some of the big giant brains here at Catholic Answers are involved in. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. So the project came about because years ago when I was first coming into the church, I had my Bible, you know, scripture reference guides. And most of them just give you, the Bible verse to use if somebody challenges you, you know, one of your Protestant friends or whatever says, hey, where's that thing? Where's this Catholic belief in the Bible?
Right.
And you want to respond. So, you know, a lot of times I'm not like Tim Staples. I can't remember every single verse in the Bible. Bible off the top of my head.
Right.
And probably most people can't. And so I would have these a guide, and but the guides usually only paraphrase the verse, and they don't really tell you how to use it. And so, and Protestants always have these really snappy comebacks to whenever you try to use it. so the idea behind the project was to, you know, you'd go to a page, there'd be a list of topics, whichever one it is that somebody's questioning you about. You'd click on that, and it would show you the most important Bible verses that you can use to help defend that topic.
Yes. Right? Okay. So like purgatory, let's just take that.
Yeah, exactly. So it'd show you, you know, a couple Bible verses. You can click on that verse and then it will drop down an explanation. It'll give you a little bit of context about the verse and how to use it in apologetics. And then down below that, there would be a list of the most common objections that you will encounter when you use that verse to try to.
Oh.
So you can anticipate objections also.
So you are fully armed and ready.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping, yeah, to be able to provide that resource to Catholics. I mean, you know, it would be like a learning resource. The more you kind of look at it and go back and refer to it, eventually you'll be able to remember that stuff on your own without having to go back to the resource. But
right.
This would be a good place to start.
So how do people find out about it? Because I went to catholic.com/Bible Project.
Yep.
That's still where you go? Or
that's
just
the place. Yep. Yeah. You go there. There's I wrote a blog post about it. That's what that URL goes to. It's a blog post about the project. It gives some more detail. It talks about the topics that we've chosen to cover first because we have to do the project in stages. It's a lot of content to produce.
Right.
So we're starting with the first 10 topics. It'll give you that list of what the topics are that we chose. We looked at, you know, based on what people search for on Catholic.com, that helped us whittle it down. But we're going to do it in phases. So next quarter, we'll pick another 10 topics and until we feel like we've got enough there to cover everything.
Catholic.com/Bible Project.
That's it, brother.
Take a look. Thank you, John. You can't talk with Stephanie Gray, our guest. That's fantastic. You know, you're pro-life. You cannot talk to her.
That's
Leave
right.
her alone.
I won't. I will. Okay.
Stephanie, I would introduce you to John, but it's all pro-choice folks today.
All right.
See you, John. We do have quite a few folks on the line. Are you ready to take calls, Stephanie?
I am ready.
Again, Stephanie Gray is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, and we are only accepting calls from people who are pro-choice. We start with Richard in Oklahoma, who's watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube, Richard. Your question for Stephanie Gray.
My question was, why shouldn't there be a choice? Why shouldn't a woman be allowed to terminate the baby?
Okay. Do you mind if I engage you in a bit of a back and forth dialogue, Richard? Would that be okay with you?
Yeah, that's perfectly fine.
Okay. So when you mentioned asking why the woman shouldn't have a choice to terminate the baby, do you believe the child is indeed a baby?
I believe the child does have a life. Or it will.
Okay. It will. So when will the individual become a human being?
When it has fully grown within the womb.
Okay, and would you acknowledge that even at birth, a child is not fully grown compared to you or me?
I acknowledge that, yes.
Do we lose Stephanie? Okay, hang on, Richard. I know that Stephanie's here with us, but we got a little technical problem. So, okay, so where Stephanie got you to, Richard, is you believe that this is a human life within the woman's womb, and you believe that even a fully developed and born baby is not as developed as we are. And so the question that I'm sure that was to follow, but what would your reasoning be that at a certain stage of development or before a certain stage of development, a person's life can be taken?
That's a good question. The way I see it is if a woman doesn't want to have a baby for a legitimate reason that affects her, you know, psychologically, or physically, then she deserves the right to terminate the life of that child.
Okay, so let's try it another way then, Richard. And we're going to get Stephanie Gray back with you. She didn't run away. We just had a technical glitch here for a moment. But okay, so if you're saying that she has the right to terminate that child, to take the life of that child, because the consequences of bearing that child are more than some acceptable level, then what is the point at development in which it's no longer permissible to take the life of the child?
After it is born.
After it is born. And we have Stephanie Gray back, so I'll let her take that. I don't know if you heard any of that, Stephanie, but I was just kind of following up with your questions and establishing when it is that Richard believes it is no longer acceptable for a mother to take that child's life. And he says at the moment that the child is born.
Okay, so if I'm 8 months pregnant, you would have no objection with me having an abortion because I'm pregnant with a female fetus and prefer a boy?
No. Okay, so the way I see it is, if your only reasoning is what you just said, then that's not a proper reason I could support.
Okay, but if I heard you correctly when I just came back on, that the child isn't alive and worth protecting until birth, then it shouldn't really matter what the reason is. If my reason is sex selection as opposed to conception from rape as opposed to any other circumstance, if it's not a human being like you or me, it shouldn't really matter. Why would you stop me from having an abortion at 8 months pregnancy because the child's female?
Oh, I'm sorry if it came out. I wouldn't stop you. I wouldn't support it.
Why wouldn't you support it?
Because, in my opinion, that's a horrible reason to terminate a child.
Okay, so it is a child. And I think that's what we're getting at is, on one hand, you know, in the initial conversation, you called the child a baby, then you said it's not a baby, but we are calling the child a child. The reality is, if the child is a human being, then don't human rights begin when a human begins? Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so but when would you say...
into consideration that... Okay, so when a kid is being raised by their parents, all the rights of the human rights are given to them outside of that house because they're not of fully age. Therefore, some rights don't belong to them.
Do you mean such as the right to vote or drive?
Yes.
Okay. So I would agree that there are some rights like civil rights that are granted to humans based on being citizens, for example, based on being of a certain age. So, for example, I'm not an American, but I am able to drive in your country, but I'm not able to vote in your country. So by being a Canadian. So therefore, there are some rights that would be based on citizenship, based on age, but would you acknowledge that there are other rights that are based on existence, such as the right to life? So it doesn't matter how old you are. According to the UN, if you're a member of the human family, would you agree with them that you have the right to life?
Yes.
Okay. And that right to life, since you existed at the age of 15, was something you had at that age?
Yeah.
Would you agree? Okay. And
yes.
Then when you were 5 years old, you would agree?
Yes.
Okay. So, and we can keep working our way back. And my point is to simply show that prior to birth, you were a living human being the way at the age of 5, 15, or the age you're at now, you're also a living human being. So at different ages, you might not have the right to vote or you might not have the right to life, but you might have the right to vote or the right to drive, but at all ages, you have the right to life. And so since at fertilization, the sperm and the egg fusing together creates a genetically distinct individual separate from the parents, then we can pinpoint at that moment being the beginning of the offspring. And if we believe in human rights, then wouldn't it follow that what we know to be a distinct living human separate from the parents to have the human rights that a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 15-year-old, or an adult would have?
Yes, I agree. Having this conversation, I agree that is true. But at the end of the day, I still believe that it is the mother's choice. If she still does not want to have that baby, she can choose to terminate it. I may not support her reasoning, but I support her right to have the choice.
Well, and I think maybe that's what we need to distinguish is what can someone do versus what should someone do. Can a woman have an abortion, whether it's legal or illegal? Yes. Just like, can someone go into a high school and shoot a bunch of innocent students? Yes, they can do that. The question isn't, can something happen? I think the question and what we're really discussing is, should something happen? Ought we commit some choices? Are all choices equal? And I think we both would agree that even though someone can go shoot innocent teenagers in a high school, they ought not do that, right? They should not do that. So even if a behavior is technically possible, if it harms innocent humans, then we don't consider it to be moral. So therefore, in the same way, even though a woman being able to have an abortion is something that she can technically do, we shouldn't support it. We shouldn't be indifferent to it, because we know it ends the life of an innocent human being the way shooting a gun at a high school ends the lives of innocent human beings. What do you think about that, Richard?
Yeah, I agree. That is wrong. But I stand by the right to, I stand by my choice to allow people to have the right to choose. Because at the end of the day, you brought up morals. At the end of the day, morals are the choices of the person, what they think.
Well, and someone who takes a gun and shoots teenagers at a school may make the argument that they think that's acceptable. But I think we'd agree that just because they say it's acceptable, it doesn't mean it is. And that there's overriding natural law principles or human rights standards that would say, hey, you can't kill innocent people.
Richard, we have to say thanks for the call. Maybe you can, I don't know if you can hear it in your phone, but the music's playing, which means we got to take a break. Stephanie Gray is our guest. Our callers are all pro-choice this hour. If you are a pro-choice caller, we welcome your call at 888-31-TRUTH. We don't even just welcome it. We appreciate it. And we'll be right back with more of those calls after this.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
We live in an age of indifference. Does truth exist? Maybe. Is there a God? Who knows? Does it matter what religion you believe in? Probably not. If you think so, fine. I'm spiritual, but not religious. Apologist Matt Nelson says this indifference is the great spiritual sickness of our age, a product of the relativism that dominates our culture. And rather than remain indifferent, he did something about it. In his new book, Just Whatever, Matt looks at the different kinds of indifference you likely encounter in your friends and family members, and maybe in yourself, and offers an antidote to the problem that plagues our age. Order your copy of Just Whatever today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Sharing the gospel with family and friends can be challenging. It's especially hard when they won't even hear you out because of all the mental roadblocks they've built up. This is Carlo Broussard, and in my new book, Prepare the Way, my aim is to help you tackle that essential first step to apologetics and evangelization, getting people to listen with an open mind. Even our best witness can bounce right off folks like these if we don't prepare the way first, breaking down barriers and leaving minds and souls free to encounter the truth. I'll give you evidence and arguments and step-by-step strategies based on asking the right questions to help them overcome their obstacles and make a straight path for the Lord. Order your copy of Prepare the Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice is our new radio show for young adults.
The Holy Spirit is about a new and exciting work in the young church of today. On Encounter, we bring young adults the life-changing testimonies of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission. Their testimonies bring faith and power into the lives of everyone who listens.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice. The spiritual awakening continues Saturday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Stephanie Gray is our guest this hour. Stephanie has devoted her life to talking about human rights and making sure that the rights that have been extended to so many parts of our society over recent centuries, outward and outward and outward go these rights, to make sure that they are applied to the elderly, ill, to the disabled, and to the unborn, who are all members of the human family and deserving of those rights. She is our guest, and we welcome your call if you are a pro-choice person and would like to discuss that with Stephanie. 888-318-7884, the number. Sylvia in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio, 88.3 FM, is next. Sylvia, you are on with Stephanie Gray. Your question, please.
Thank you. My question is, because I would really like to be pro-life, but I have one problem with when a woman or a child is raped and then finds themselves pregnant, and they don't want to carry the child because that reminds them of the situation. Like, what is the, like, how do you go around that?
You know, that's a fair question, Sylvia. I think we have to have profound sympathy for victims of sexual assault. We need to really journey with them to find healing. One of the things that stood out to me is you said that, you know, if a victim of sexual assault were to get pregnant, that they would be reminded of the rape that had happened. Do you think if a rape victim gets pregnant and has an abortion, that she will forget about the rape?
You know, but then she doesn't have the child to raise, and, you know, I think it might be easier. I mean, I don't, you know, just hypothetical, but...
Mm-hmm. You know...
No, definitely the abortion won't totally, you know, fix the issue. I agree with that.
Right. So I think we can start with that understanding that abortion is not going to undo the rape that has happened. So then the next question I think we can ask ourselves is it fair to give the death penalty to the innocent child? That's a consequence we don't even give to the rapist. Even in a state where someone commits rape, if they haven't committed murder, they're actually, as a rapist, not going to be given the death penalty. So we're talking about giving a consequence to one of the innocent parties, the preborn child, that we're not even giving to the rapist. Do you see that there's a problem with that?
Yeah, that is an excellent argument. That never even crossed my mind, ever. Yeah.
Well, it's always good. I think that's the power of questions to get us to think about things that we haven't perhaps considered before. And, you know, a couple of the points that I would put out there is I have a friend who got pregnant from rape and had an abortion. And interestingly, she said she had a harder time being healed from the abortion than being healed from the rape. And the reasoning she gave was she said when she was raped, she was the innocent party. But when she had the abortion, she felt like she became the aggressor, that she was doing to an innocent party, in a sense, a type of violation that had been done to her, although it manifested itself differently. So I think ultimately we need to remember abortion is not going to take the trauma of the rape away. And it's also going to involve a situation where the woman is making a choice to harm someone else. Now, I will certainly throw the caveat in there, although that is the observation of my friend. There is no denying that her or anyone who's been a victim of sexual assault is in an emotionally fragile state, that they have been traumatized, and that their degree of complicity and involvement is very different from someone with full knowledge without an emotionally distressing situation moves ahead and makes the choice to have an abortion. But it nonetheless, at the end of the day, if not forced, is still a decision someone has made that they're going to need healing from, as my friend did ultimately find healing. You know, she repented, she experienced the mercy of God from the choice she made to harm her child. Contrast her with another friend of mine. My friend Leanna got pregnant at the age of 12 as a result of rape, and she decided to carry through with the pregnancy. And interestingly, while she was pregnant, she was so traumatized by memories of the sexual assault that she was tempted to kill herself through suicide. But because she was pregnant, she didn't kill herself because she knew that would end the life of the child. And although she herself was so traumatized she didn't want to keep living, she didn't want to harm the child's life. And so what she said to me when she was telling me her story story was, she said, I saved my child's life, but she saved mine. It was the very existence of that vulnerable human being that caused her to hang on with her own life and ultimately preserve her child's life. And while many people in that situation might place a child for adoption, and that's a great alternative, in the case of my friend Leanna, she actually chose to parent her child and raised her daughter, and her daughter became her best friend.
How's all that, Sylvia?
Well, I am blown away. That never even crossed my mind, either of these scenarios. And I think talking to people who went through it, even though it's probably very difficult for them, would really help people like me, because that now I have a lot to think about.
Sylvia, how wonderful to take your call. Thank you so much. You wanted to say something to Sylvia before she went?
Yeah, I just going to say, you know, I appreciate your intellectual honesty and your openness to just ask good questions and be receptive to the type of information that's out there. And I think, as you've realized, stories are very powerful, and there's the core truth that we need to communicate, but the lived experiences of my friends Nicole and Leanna really grip us to go to that truth through the experience of another.
Thanks, Sylvia. I wonder how much you would agree with this, Stephanie, that there's a way in which our society doesn't call people to moral greatness, doesn't believe in asking people to rise up to a very high moral standard. But in many ways, women, even less than men, there's almost a kind of patronizing, oh, you're a victim kind of thing. And you certainly are a victim. I mean, if you've been raped, you've been victimized. That's a horror. But the moral greatness that women are capable of, it almost seems like we have we've abandoned even talking about that.
Right. Now, absolutely, we want to continually be challenging people no matter what they've experienced. They still choose the response. I mean, that's the philosophy of Dr. Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor and psychiatrist who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning. And one of his observations was the last of the human freedoms that can never be taken from us is the freedom to choose how to respond to the situation we're in. And our world has perverted that perspective. And they have said the last of the human freedoms that can't be taken from us is the freedom to choose. Period, end of sentence. And no, it's the rest of that sentence which is most significant. What can't ever be taken from you or me or any of our callers is the freedom to choose how to respond to the situation we're in.
Right.
We don't have to choose abortion. We don't have to go down that path. We can choose another way. And that's the most powerful choice of all, that we can rise to greater virtue, that we can do the right thing even when it's hard. We choose how we respond, not just choose. We choose how.
Next caller, Anonymous in Denver, listening on 1060 AM. You are on with Stephanie Gray, Anonymous. Your question.
Hi, guys. Hey, thank you for taking my call. As back in medical ethics class, I remember there was an argument, and I hope I do it justice because, it's been a little bit. But, the argument, the analogy kind of, goes along the lines of, if someone, if you invite someone, into your home, and, during that invitation, it comes out to be that, they have to stay within your home for 9 months and live on your couch, otherwise they will die. Where is the, moral imperative that you, must keep this person, in your home for the 9 months? I hope you get the gist, of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that moral imperative, come from?
Yeah, great question. I think the way to know whether you ought to keep the person in your house for 9 months on your couch or not is to ask yourself if the individual is your child and are you the parent? Because I think civil societies all acknowledge that parents have a responsibility to their offspring that they don't have to strangers. So while it's nice of us to go feed people who are homeless in our cities, if we don't feed those people, we will not be charged with neglect for refusing to do so. But if we have our own children in our own home and we refuse to feed our children, we refuse to meet the basic needs of our children. In fact, if we throw our children out of the home and say they have to live outside, and those children are minors, incapable of caring for themselves, then we would be charged with neglect. So I would say that parents have a responsibility to meet the basic needs of their offspring. And I think generally that's an accepted principle in civil societies. So since we can establish that the preborn child is offspring of the parent and that is a minor incapable of caring for herself, the parent therefore has a duty in the same way the parent has a duty to allow the two-year-old to stay in the house, sitting on the couch and eating food in the kitchen. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, that's an argument that I didn't hear, you know, in my medical ethics class. And, you know, I think I do like that perspective. That's interesting. Now, would you use the same argument then if the person was uninvited into the home?
Well, I would say if the person was uninvited, in the case of pregnancy, we're dealing with someone who is still your offspring. So let's take it, I don't know if you heard the last caller, but we were talking about pregnancy as a result of rape. So even in that case where you could argue the rape victim did not consent to the sex, which in any other case where it was consensual would have been inviting the child in, so to speak, she nonetheless is the parent. And parents not only have a duty to meet their child's basic needs, but I think another element we could add is there's a difference between an adult who can care for themselves versus a child who can't. So I would say I have a responsibility, even if my sister visits with my niece or nephew and the child is clearly neither of those two are my children. Nonetheless, if my sister were suddenly to leave the home, I couldn't just do anything to my niece and nephew because they're children and they get special rights due to their immaturity and vulnerability.
Anonymous, thank you for the call. We have to take a break, so we'll leave it there for now. Again, Stephanie Gray is our guest. Our number, 888-31-TRUTH. And if you are a pro-choice caller, this hour is for you. We'll be right back with more with Stephanie Gray right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Tim Staples here. Since May is the month of Mary and Mother's Day, I'm offering a great opportunity for you to help yourself, your family, and your friends to get to know our Blessed Mother more deeply than ever before. And to help make that happen, we're offering my book, Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines for only $9.95. Folks, that's over 45% off the regular price. From her Immaculate Conception to the Annunciation, from her title as Mother of God, to her perpetual virginity, from her assumption into heaven to her role as co-redemptrix, I'll give you all the facts and back them up with solid biblical evidence in a way that's easy to read, remember, and understand. Make this May the month you, your friends, and your family grow closer to the Mother of the Church, our Mother Mary. To get your copies of Behold Your Mother, call 1-888-291-8000 or log on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Atheists have often viewed belief in God as wishful thinking, a projection of an idea because man fears death. But is this a fair claim? The answer is no, and here are some reasons why. First, not everyone accepts God's existence for this reason. There are many who acknowledge his existence on the grounds of reasonable arguments. Second, even if someone does believe in God for this reason, it says nothing whether or not the proposition, God exists, is true. And finally, third, the theist could turn the table and say atheists reject God simply because they're scared of a divine rule maker and don't want to submit. Obviously, this is not evidence that can be used in support of theism. So, is atheism justified because belief in God is wishful thinking? Absolutely not. I'm Carlo Broussard with The Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Stephanie Gray is our guest this hour on Catholic Answers Live. She holds a certificate with distinction in healthcare ethics from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. She wrote A Physician's Guide to Discussing Abortion and Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating Truth. Stephanie, a couple of things. Love Unleashes Life is also your website, loveunleasheslife.com.
That's right. Okay. Yes.
So people can reach you there. And you're going to be talking at the Wilberforce weekend at the Colson Center. That's not Catholic. Those are evangelicals.
Look at that. Catholics and evangelicals working together.
What?
I won't be the only Catholic at that conference. There's going to be a priest from, I forget the name of the organization. But if you go to the Wilberforce weekend, you can learn more about the program. The theme is to create, to confront, and to care. So I am the presenter on to confront and how we can confront people with wisdom and charity. So I'm really excited to be able to share to this very influential group of evangelicals the events put on by the Colson Center. And people can learn more if they just go to my website, loveunleasheslife.com. There's a link in my upcoming events.
So why would they think of you as to confront? That is one of the most delightful things about you, Stephanie, is you have no fear at all. You're happy to confront. As a matter of fact, I just have this sense you enjoy it. You enjoy the intellectual, I don't know if battle is the right word, but jousting or that's fun for you.
I was one of those people that never liked sports, and people will say to me, you know, my doctor said to me the other day, so what do you do for exercise? And I'm like, I don't. So I don't like to exert myself physically, but intellectually, I love to exert myself. So all of the physical gets pointed upwards towards the intellectual, and it just find it energizing.
Yeah, but you do it with charity, which is also a very nice quality. Lots of callers and a little time. So let's go to Ingrid in Yakima, Washington, listening on 88.1 FM. Ingrid, thank you so much for your call. Your question for Stephanie Gray.
Absolutely. I have a question in regards to the quickening or the time of when the spirit enters the body and how it relates to the gestational development, at what stage of viability is concerned in medical terms.
Okay, so you want to know when a human soul is joined to that human body that's developing. Am I getting the right idea there, Ingrid?
Yeah, my understanding is that there has been some time that the quickening is called the time that the human soul is in the body. I don't know if that's accurate. That seems more like just the general random movements, but just when the mother can feel it.
I gotcha. Okay.
So, yeah.
Right.
Stephanie, your take.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And there is this historical idea that people in history had that when the mother can feel the child move, that therefore that's must be when the soul enters the body. But I would say that came about as a result of primitive knowledge of prenatal development. And so we just have so much more information now about how the child in utero grows and when the child comes to be. Although we can't prove the exact moment of ensoulment because that is a metaphysical question, I would say I lean to the perspective that the most reasonable case to make is the idea that you would have ensoulment at conception. For the reason being, where you have a body, I believe you have a soul, because I believe it's the soul which animates the body. And so therefore, we know at fertilization or conception, that one cell growing into 2, 4, 8, and 16 cells, doubling every time and so forth, we know that that individual is a living body biologically. And so therefore, I think it makes the most sense to say the soul would therefore exist as that body exists. Now, some people say, but what about twinning? You know, what can happen is about a week or two within pregnancy, one human, in the case of identical twins, can split into two. And therefore, did you have two souls at fertilization? Did a second soul come into existence at twinning? Or do both not get souls until the moment of twinning? And I would say, well, where you have one body, you have one soul. And if you get a second body, it makes the most sense to me that you would suddenly get a second soul when you get a second body. It's kind of like if you look at a flatworm, if you actually cut a flatworm in half, rather than killing the flatworm, two worms will now crawl on the table. Well, it doesn't mean prior to cutting the flatworm, you didn't have a worm. You did. It just means that in this amazing situation, one worm can suddenly become two. So in the same way with humans, you have an amazing situation. My mother is one example of that. She's an identical twin. So either she...
Ah, Ingrid, hang on. Again, a technical problem with Stephanie. Ingrid, are you still there with us?
I'm still here, yes.
If I could, just while we're waiting to get Stephanie back, and we will get her back again, it's just a little problem we're having today with some device somewhere. Is your question connected to the idea that if the soul were to enter the body, say, at quickening, if that were the case, that abortion before that point would be acceptable?
Well, actually, at this point, I'm leaning more towards the viability reasoning, but that's more.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that I made clear, as in Catholic teaching, if the church doesn't say it knows for sure when a human soul enters a body, but it does say that every human being is God's child. So there's no point at whatever a person might come down on as far as where the soul enters the body. If you're a member of the human species, you are a party to all the rights of every member of the human species. Now, as a child, certainly some of those are held in trust for you by your parents as you grow, but they can't just be wantonly violated by your parents. You know, parents can't just brutally beat children, for example. The child has a bodily integrity that has to be respected. So I just want to, while we were waiting for Stephanie to come back, I did just want to make that point. I don't know if that's related to what you're asking, but for our listeners to be aware, the Catholic teaching on abortion doesn't change no matter when the fully rational human soul is present. The Catholic teaching says, science tells us that human life begins at conception. Accepting what science teaches, every member of the human species, it has all the rights that belong to each and every member of the human species. I see we have Stephanie back. You wanted to continue with Ingrid.
Well, you know, one thing I would just add, I think I'm going to just hang up the phone there. You can hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Great. Okay, wonderful. So one thing I would add, having heard you kind of wrap up that whole point, is that if we go back to the original question about quickening, you know, we could think of an analogy. Imagine someone sneaks into your home and hides under your bed, and they're going to scare you, and you come home 30 minutes later, and you're unaware they're in the house. And then an hour after you've been puttering around in the kitchen, they suddenly jump out and scare you. Did they only exist the moment you became aware of them in your house? Did they only enter your house at that moment? Obviously not. They were in your house for an hour and 30 minutes, but you only became aware of it 90 minutes into their time in the house. So in the same way, someone may only physically feel the child several months into pregnancy in terms of the child kicking, but it doesn't mean the child didn't exist for the months leading up to the kicking. The child existed at the moment of fertilization. We know that biologically, and therefore we ought to protect that human. And as Sai pointed out, yes, there theologians will debate the exact moment of ensoulment, but there's no debate about the exact moment of the biological physical body coming into existence. And I am one of those people that leans to the, I think, case that can reasonably be made that if we've got a body at fertilization, I think it makes sense that we have a soul. But that is debated, and it can't be proven because it's a metaphysical question.
So Ingrid, we talked a lot at you. Your response?
The flip side of the question is, at what point in whether a body is biologically still functioning, so say, for example, in a life that has been traumatized due to an accident or something like that and is on full medical support, that body, that life, that consciousness is no longer viable, and they have determined that this person is no longer here. Their body is still functioning, but this person is no longer here. And it's generally accepted that life support is to be ended or whatever. At what point in time is that recognized, when the life is no longer viable outside of the womb on a physical basis? It's still a metaphysical question. At what point is the viability, so to speak, of life a question of, well, the heart is still pumping, or it's getting assistance because we have machines that keep the body alive. So if the body is there, the soul is still there, even if that person is no longer really there.
Yeah, I think the question is more a question of, is someone living or is someone dying? So when the child is growing in the womb and we were to ask, is someone living or someone dying? The answer is, someone is living. That's the environment the child needs. That's the stage of development the child is at, that all humans go through at that stage of development. When someone is, you know, maybe 50 years old or 10 years old or 90 years old, but they have some, you know, disease that has overtaken their body, and we were to ask, are they living or are they dying? They are still alive, but they may be going through the dying process, or process, as Americans like to say. And so as someone's going through that dying process, we need to ask ourselves ethically, is any intervention that I do ordinary or extraordinary? Or other language that is sometimes used by ethicists is, would this intervention be proportionate or would it be disproportionate? In other words, would this intervention have a hope of benefit and not be excessively burdensome? Or would it have no hope of benefit and actually be excessively burdensome? And so when it comes to certain treatments, let's say chemotherapy, and someone has had multiple rounds of chemo, it's not really doing the job. And in fact, they're told if they do it again, they're going to have all the consequences of chemo, which are excessively burdensome. And by the way, it's not going to take your cancer away. In that situation, it's totally reasonable for someone to, in a sense, withdraw treatment, to say no more to this intervention, because unfortunately, they're dying, the cancer is taking over their body. But saying that you can cease an intervention which is disproportionate is not the same as saying you can cease normal care, which is proportionate for a human at that stage of development, which is the situation for a child in the womb. What do you think about that?
No, I completely understand that. There's two different sides of the whole abortion thing that I look at and wrestle with. And on a moral side, there is the aspect of, as you're saying, the viability of a life of growing and becoming what could possibly be deserves a whole different way of treatment than on the way out of life. It still needs to be with care and with compassion.
Ingrid, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to leave it there because we are at the very limit of our time. Thank you so much for the call, Ingrid. Call anytime. Stephanie Gray, thanks for a great hour.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
I just get a kick out of the Canadian woman with the smile on her face and the heart of a lion fighting for the unborn. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Don't forget about Stephanie's book, Love Unleashes Life, Abortion and the Art of Communicating Truth. You can find out more about her at loveunleasheslife.com. We'll see you tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.